to the rush of day, when the heat of a rolling wave can't be turned away. An enchanted moment, and it sees me through. It's enough for this restless warrior just to be with you. And can you feel the love tonight? It is where we are. It's enough for this wide-eyed wanderer that we got this far. Can you feel the love tonight? I was led to rest. It's enough to make kings and vagabonds leave.
Greetings, everybody. This is Beth from Galactic Roundtable. I'm so glad you're back with me tonight. We're going to have a CE5 event to call in the extraterrestrials. I'm so excited about this. I'm a little bit weary tonight. I came back from Joshua Tree, contact in the desert in California, about 2 a.m., and I haven't had much sleep for about a week. It may have been the largest UFO and extraterrestrial conference held that we know about until date. It was close to 2,000 people. It was extremely exceptional gathering of the presenters and the folks that, you know, look forward to these events. I'll be talking more about that in two posts that I'm going to do, write-ups about my experiences there. So look for those on my website. Now let's begin our contact event. Following this, we're going to listen to my recent interview with Grant Cameron, and he will speak on consciousness. So enjoy this, everybody. Here we go.
Greetings, everybody. This is Beth from Galactic Roundtable. Welcome. Tonight I am leading a CE5 event. We are here to call in the ships. We are here to have communication with the extraterrestrials. One universe, one people, one love. The path to the divine and the unlimited joy associated with it, activated solely by intention. The will to grow and understand the meaning and possibilities of one's life. The greater the purity of aspiration, the more powerful the response from the realm of inspiration and grace, from the realm of the extraterrestrials. As one develops and as understanding dawns, it is normal for the intention itself to ripen and become more intense. As the aspiration unfolds, it flowers into the intention to make an offering of one's life, to use one's life energy for the upliftment and love and inspiration of all beings within humanity and our galactic family. This brings you immediately into harmony with the vibration of the highest truth, with the supreme being, which is all love. Tonight we are going to initiate a contact experience with our extraterrestrial friends. As we initiate an interactive experience with the extraterrestrials, we first begin by doing an invocation to invite in the highest beings of light. Following that, I will do a guided meditation with you. During the guided meditation, you may also visualize the coherent thought sequence to call extraterrestrials to where you are now. I invite you to close your eyes, make yourself in a comfortable place, and take long, slow, deep breaths. This initiative is dedicated to the planetary and cosmic hierarchy. This includes all the archangels and angels, the Alohi and the elementals, the plasma forms of light, and all the Christed extraterrestrials, such as the Ashtar Command, the beloved Arcturians, the Pleiadians, and Sirians, only to name a few. We begin this meditation. Imaho. Though the single nature of mind, which completely pervades both cyclic existence and nirvana, has been naturally present from the beginning, you have not recognized it, even though its radiance and awareness have never been interrupted. You have not yet encountered its true face, even though it arises unimpededly in every facet of existence. You have not as yet recognized this single nature of mind. In order that this single nature might be recognized by you, the conquerors of the three times have taught an inconceivably vast number of practices, including the 84,000 aspects of the sacred teachings. Yet, despite this diversity, not even one of these teachings has been given by the conquerors outside the context of an understanding of this nature. And even there are inestimable volumes of sacred writings, equally vast as the limits of space. Actually, these teachings can be succinctly expressed in a few words, which are the introduction to awareness. Here is the direct face-to-face introduction to the enlightened intention of the conquerors. Here is the method for entering the actual reality in this very moment without reference to the past or future events. Kaho, O fortunate children, listen to these words. The terms mind is commonplace and widely used, yet there are those who do not understand its meaning, those who falsely understand it, those who partially understand it, and those who have not quite understood its genuine reality. Thus, there has arisen an inconceivably vast number of assertions as to the nature of mind, posited by the various philosophical systems. Further, since ordinary persons do not understand the meaning of the term mind and do not intuitively recognize its nature, they continue to roam through the six classes of sentient rebirth within the three world system and consequently experience suffering. This is the fault of not understanding the intrinsic nature of mind. Even though pious attendants and hermit Buddhas claim that they understand this single nature of mind as the partial absence of self, they do not understand it exactly as it is. Furthermore, being fettered by opinions held in accordance with their respective literatures and philosophical systems, there are those who do not perceive the inner radiance directly. The pious attendants and hermit Buddhas are obscured in this respect by their attachment to the subject-object dichotomy. The adherents of Madhyatmaka are observed by their attachment to the extremes of the two truths. The practitioners of Kriya Tantra and Yoga Tantra are observed by their attachment to the extremes of ritual service and attainment. The practitioners of Mahayoga and Anyu Yoga are obscured by their attachment to the extremes of space and awareness. All these practitioners stray from the point because they polarize the non-dual reality. And since they fail to unify these extremes in non-duality, they do not attain Buddhahood. Thus, all those beings continue to roam in cyclic existence because they presently engage in forms of renunciation and in acts of rejection and acceptance with regard to their own minds, where, in reality, cyclic existence and nirvana are inseparable. Therefore, one should abandon all constructed teachings and all unnatural states free from activity. And by virtue of this, introduction to awareness, natural liberation through naked perception, which is presented here, one should realize all things in the context of this great liberation. So it is that enlightened attributes are brought to completion with the great perfection. Be certain that the nature of mind is empty and without foundation. One's own mind is unsubstantial, like any empty sky. Look at your own mind to see whether it is like that or not. Divorced from views which constructedly determine the nature of emptiness. Be certain that pristine cognition, naturally originating, is primordially radiant, just like the nucleus of the sun, which is itself naturally originating. Look at your own mind to see whether it is like that or not. Be certain that the awareness, which is the pristine cognition, is uninterrupted. Like the coursing central torrent of a river which flows unceasingly, look at your own mind to see whether it is like that or not. Be certain that conceptual thoughts and fleeting memories are not strictly indefensible. Be certain that conceptual thoughts and fleeting memories are not strictly identifiable, but insubstantial in their motion, like the breezes of the atmosphere. Look at your own mind to see whether it is like that or not. Be certain that all appears is naturally manifest in the mind, like the images in a mirror which also appear naturally. Look at your own mind to see whether it is like that or not. Be certain that all characteristics are liberated right where they are, like the clouds of the atmosphere naturally originating and naturally dissolving. Look at your own mind to see whether it is like that or not. There are no phenomena extraneous to those that originate from the mind. So how could there be anything on which to meditate apart from the mind? There are no phenomena extraneous to those that originate from the mind. So there are no modes of conduct to be undertaken extraneous to those that originate from the mind. There are no phenomena extraneous that originates from the mind, so there are no commitments to be kept erroneous to those that originate from the mind. There are no phenomena extraneous to those that originate from the mind, so there are no results to be attained extraneous to those that originate from the mind. There are no phenomena extraneous to those that originate from the mind. So one should observe one's own mind, looking into its nature again and again. If upon looking outwards towards the external expanse of the sky, there are no projections emanated by the mind, and if on looking inward at one's own mind, there is no projectionist who projects thoughts by thinking them, then one's own mind, completely free from conceptual projections, will become luminously clear. This intrinsic awareness, union of inner radiance and emptiness, is the Bodhi Bhava. This intrinsic awareness, union of inner radiance and emptiness, is the Buddha body of reality, appearing like the illumining effect of a sunrise on a clear and cloudless sky. On a clear and cloudless sky. It is a clearly knowable, despite its lack of specific shape or form. There is a great distinction between those who understand and those who misunderstand this point. This naturally originating inner radiance, uncreated from the very beginning, is the parentless child of awareness. How amazing! It is the naturally originating pristine cognition, uncreated by anyone. How amazing! This radiant awareness has never been born and will never die. How amazing! Though manifestly radiant, it lacks an extraneous perceiver. How amazing! Though it is roamed throughout cyclic existence, it does not degenerate. How amazing! Though it has seen Buddhahood itself, it does not improve. How amazing! Though it is present in everyone, it remains unrecognized. How amazing! Still, one hopes for some attainment other than this. How amazing! Though it is present within oneself, one continues to seek it elsewhere. How amazing! Ama! This immediate awareness, unsubstantial and radiant, is itself the highest of all views. This non-referential, all-encompassing awareness, which is free in every respect, is itself the highest of all meditations. This uncontrived activity based on awareness, simply expressed in worldly terms, is itself the highest of all types of conduct. This unsought attainment of awareness spontaneously presents from the beginning, spontaneously present from the beginning, is itself the highest of all results. Now, the four great media, which are errorless, are presented. First, the great medium of errorless view is this radiant immediate awareness. Since it is radiant and without error, it is called a medium. Second, the great medium of errorless meditation is that radiant immediate awareness. Since it is radiant and without error, it is called a medium. Third, the great medium of errorless conduct is this radiant immediate awareness. Since it is radiant and without error, it is called a medium. Fourth, the great medium of errorless result is this radiant immediate awareness. Since it is radiant and without error, it is called the medium. Now, the four great nails, which are unchanging, are presented. First, the great nail of the unchanging view is this radiant immediate awareness. Since it is firm throughout the three times, it is called a nail. Second, the great nail of unchanging meditation is this radiant immediate awareness. Since it is firm throughout the three times, it is called a nail. Third, the great nail of unchanging conduct is this radiant immediate awareness. Since it is firm throughout the three times, it is called nail. Fourth, the great nail of all unchanging result. Is this radiant immediate awareness? Since it is firm throughout the three times, it is called nail. Now follows the esoteric instruction which reveals the three times to be one. Abandon your notions of the past without attributing a temporal sequence. Cut off your mental associations regarding the future without anticipation. Rest in a spacious modality without clinging to the thoughts of the present. Do not meditate at all, since there is nothing upon which to meditate. The awareness, free from the eight extremes such as externalism and nihilism and so forth, is called the middle way, which does not fall into any extremes. It is called awareness because mindfulness is uninterrupted. It is given the name nucleus of the Tathagata because emptiness is naturally endowed with this nucleus of awareness. If one understands this truth, one reaches perfection in all aspects, for which reason this awareness is also called the perfection of discriminative awareness. Furthermore, it is called the great seal because it transcends the intellect and is a temporally free from extremes. And further, it is called the ground of all because this awareness is the ground of all joys and sorrows associated with cyclic existence and nirvana. The distinction between these two contingent on whether or not the awareness is realized. Further, this radiant and lucid awareness is itself referred to as ordinary consciousness on account of those periods when it abides in its natural state in an ordinary, non-exceptional way. Thus, however, many well-conceived and pleasant-sounding names are applied to this awareness. In reality, those who maintain that these names do not refer to this present conscious awareness, but to something else above and beyond it, resemble someone who has already found an elephant but is out looking for its tracks elsewhere. Though no one were to scan the entire external universe, searching for the nature of mind, one would not find it. Buddhahood cannot be attained other than through the mind. Not recognizing this, one does indeed search for the mind eventually, yet how can one find one's own mind when one looks for it elsewhere? This is a little fool, for example, who, when finding himself amidst a crowd of people, becomes mesmerized by the spectacle of the crowd and forgets himself. Then, no longer recognizing who he is, starts searching elsewhere for himself, continuously mistaking others for himself. Similarly, since one does not discern the abiding nature, which is the fundamental reality of all things, one is cast in the cyclic existence, not knowing what appearances are to be identified with the mind, and not discovering one's own mind to be the Buddha, nirvana becomes obscured. Now, with regard to the diversity of relative appearances, they are perishable. Not one of them is genuinely existent. All phenomenal existence, all the things of cyclic existence and nirvana, are the discernible manifestations of the unique essential nature of one's own mind. This is known because whenever one's own external continuum undergoes change, there will arise the indiscernible manifestation of an external change. Therefore, all things are the discernible manifestations of mind. For example, the six classes of living beings discern phenomenal appearances in their different ways. Externalistic extremes and others who are remote from the Buddha perspective perceive appearances in terms of a dichotomy of externalism and nihilism. The followers of the nine sequences of the vehicle perceive appearances in terms of their respective views and so forth. For as long as the diversity, not appearance, of being personified and diversely elucidated. Differences as to the nature of appearances are apprehended, and consequently bewilderment becomes about through attachment to these respective views. If this nature of intrinsic awareness is understood, virtuous and negative acts will be liberated right where they are. But if this single nature is not understood, one will amass nothing but future lives within cyclic existence, which is higher and higher and lower realms. Regardless of whether one has engaged in virtuous or non-virtuous actions, yet if one's own mind is simply understood to be pristine cognition, utterly empty of inherent existence, the consequences of virtuous and negative actions will never come to fruition. For just as a spring cannot materialize in empty space within the realization of emptiness, virtuous and negative actions do not objectively exist. So it is that, for the purpose of nakedly perceiving the manifestly present intrinsic awareness, the natural liberation through naked perception is most profound. Thus, by following the instruction, one should familiarize oneself with the intrinsic awareness, profoundly sealed. Ima, this introduction to awareness, natural liberation through naked perception, has been composed for the sake of future generations, the sentient beings of a degenerative state, sentient beings of a degenerate age. It integrates in a purposeful, concise abridgment all my preferred tantras, transmissions, and esoteric instructions. Though I have disseminated it all this present time, it will be concealed as a precious treasure. May it be encountered by those of the future who have a positive inheritance of past actions. Samaya, Rigya, Rigya, Rigya. Now visualize yourself in a beautiful mountain forest. It is twilight and almost dark. The valley is shrouded in mist. Tall pine trees, firs, and spruce stretch silently towards the pearly sky. It is quiet. It is peaceful. You inhale deeply the cool evening air filled with the spice of evergreen. You are comfortably dressed and you feel wonderful. Now the sun sets over the mountain. You watch its warming rays burn away the evening mists. As you look around, you notice a small pathway leading up the mountain, and you decide to climb and explore. The path is a little rough, but you proceed with ease, climbing higher, stopping every now and then to look at the view below. Finally, your path opens onto a wide ledge of smooth rock. You decide to sit down and rest a while. The fog has lifted completely now, and you can overlook the entire valley spread below, the forested mountains and the river gorge cutting deeply through the valley. You look around on the sky and the horizon, and you see your extraterrestrial brothers and sisters are joining you there. They twinkle their lightship's lights at you. They bring up their lights to full on, and then slowly fade back down to complete dark. You are so happy to be joined by your extraterrestrial galactic family. And you're celebrating with them. High above the valley, you notice several large ships circling in the evening air, catching the air currents on silky wings, swooping swishing and diving their saucers, at times coming quite close to you, beckoning you. Yes, the saucers are inviting you to join them in their evening flight. You know you can do this, and as soon as you accept, there you are, floating and gliding in the clear blue sky over the valley. You know you are perfectly safe. You are free. You can soar as high as you wish in perfect freedom and enjoyment. Feel yourself rise, the wind supporting your wings, the sun warming you. Feel the sky inviting you to expand. This is your world. Let yourself be lifted to glide and soar peacefully, blissfully. Very slowly bring yourself down from the sky. Float back to your comfortable rocky ledge and feel the solid ground under your feet. Then take another look at the saucers whose flight you were privileged to have shared. Offer your thanks for this unique experience. Then let the scene slowly fade from your mind. Become aware of your surroundings again and take time to gently awaken your body. Take a few slow breaths and gently stretch your body. Feel new energy and circulate your body, leaving you refreshed and relaxed. Thank you, everybody, for joining me tonight in this CE5 experience, making contact with our extraterrestrial friends and family. Namaste.
Okay, you'll have to let me know how that was for you. Let's begin now and listen to this interview with Grant Cameron on consciousness.
I'm really pleased today to bring to you an interview with Grant Cameron. Many of you are familiar with Grant's work with the presidential UFOs and also his witness testimony at the Citizens Hearing for Disclosure. Grant's most recent book, UFOs, Area 51, and Government Informants, you may be familiar with. It came out less than a year ago. However, there's been a recent shift in the work that Grant Cameron's doing, and his work is leading us into consciousness now. Consciousness really is all that there is. So I'd like to welcome Grant here. Greetings.
Well, Beth, thank you for having me on. I appreciate your taking interest in the research that I'm doing.
It's very exciting stuff. My listening audience is very familiar with the discussions on consciousness and how it's related to all of these things.
Beautiful.
So I wanted to ask you, I heard a rumor that you are formulating a new book, and I was wondering if, before we begin the interview, if you wouldn't mind touching on that for us.
Yeah, I guess I can basically tell you the story of what happened. That, as you pointed out, I used to do the presidents and UFOs. And all this goes back to a sighting I had in 1975. I had a number of sightings in 1975. Mm. There was a flap of sightings that were going on outside of the major city that I live in Manitoba, Canada. Mm. And I saw the sighting. I was quite impressed. Got all my friends who didn't really want to be involved and wrote a manuscript which didn't get published. Mm. It's at a publisher right now, but didn't get published at that time. The woman that should have published it said to me, "Mr. Cameron, you may believe in this kind of stuff. Count me among the unbelievers." And what happened was at that point, I just basically said, all I'm really interested in now, I'm not really interested in science because it's, you know, people like to hear the stories, but it's really not proving anything. It's really not proving anything. So I basically said, all I'm interested in is, what did I see? Somebody in the world has to have the answer to what I saw. Somebody has to know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And I started this long sort of 39-year trip to find out what was the answer to what I had seen in 1975. And I had my first year sightings. I was pretty close to this object.
Right.
And anyway, I went to the Canadian government. Then I went to the former president of Penn State University, Dr. Eric Walker, a guy with 14 honorary doctorate degrees. Very powerful defense guy who indicated he knew what was going on. We went to him. We tried to get the answer out of him. He sort of knew what was going on. The Canadian government knew what was going on.
Right.
And I found out the president knew what was going on. Mm. And basically, I came to the conclusion that really he knew, but they were never going to tell anybody. And so I sort of got a little bit depressed with this whole situation, still wanting the answer to what had I seen.
Sure.
And what happened was that it was at that point where I'm in a lecture. I've told this story numerous times. I'm at a lecture in Phoenix, Arizona. This is February of 2012. I'm watching Colin Andrews.
Yes.
And if you've never interviewed Colin Andrews, you should interview him on consciousness, because he and I are on the same path, and he's the one that led me onto this path. I'm a guy who was shooting some documents. I was doing some of the hard research, trying to get the cover-up undone and all this kind of stuff. And it was during this lecture, Colin was giving the lecture. I really wasn't going to go to the lecture. This is a UFO Congress, which runs for about a week, and so lots of lectures you don't go to, so you choose which lecture to go to.
Right, and just to interject to let everybody know, Colin is the crop circles guy.
Yeah, he's the guy that invented the term crop circle. And so he's giving this lecture, and he'd given a lecture back in 2000. And during that lecture, he'd been financed by Lawrence Rockefeller. Mm-hmm. And they had hired private investigators. They'd run around Britain, and they tried to discover how many of the crop circles are real, how many of them are being hoaxed. And he came to the conclusion that 80% were being hoaxed.
Right.
Which sort of ended his UFO career in 2000. Nobody wanted to talk to him. They figured he was working for the government. You know, he'd become a bad guy. And so in 2012, now he's giving a lecture in Phoenix. And I figured, well, he's a very prominent guy. He's been around for a while. I should go pay him respect, go watch his lecture. So right. I figured, okay, I'm going to go watch the lecture. The lecture was like consciousness and crop circles. Mm. And I sit this lecture, and I'm watching the lecture, and I get what I call a download. I'm sitting there, and I've been working at that time for 37 years on UFOs, right. Trying to find out what was the answer to the whole UFO thing, what it was all about,
right.
And stuff started to pop into my head. Things that I had done during my career, things that high-level officials had said that I really didn't catch on to what they were saying. And the one thing, and it all came down to the fact that it all had to do with consciousness. It was the fact that consciousness is the answer this whole problem. And the three things that really popped into my head were three key things. One was a top secret memo, which was written by the Canadian government in November of 1950. I've talked about it, and Friedman's talked about it. Everybody talks about this document. It's a top right. secret document, one of the only top secret documents ever written in ufology. Government doesn't deny the document exists. In that document, what happens is the Canadians are going to the Americans, and they want to find out from the Americans, what's the deal with flying saucers? They're interested. They go to the American embassy. They go to they use the Canadian military liaison mm-hmm. to the U.S. military. And he goes and he asks a bunch of questions. Right. The answers come back to the Canadian embassy, and they're spelled out in the top secret memo. They spell it out. They say, we told the Americans that flying saucers exist. It's the most highly classified subject in the United States. There's a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush. Vannevar Bush was the guy who was the scientific guy in charge of the science for the atomic bomb. Proximity fuse, jet engine,
right.
plastic explosives, homing torpedo, everything drove World War II. He was the science advisor,
right.
very powerful guy, and it says he's in charge of trying to figure out what UFOs are about. The fourth thing that they said was the Americans say this subject is of tremendous significance, and then the thing that popped into my head while I was watching this lecture is the very next line, which I had read, but it never really got the significance of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, we were also told by American officials that other things might be associated with the flying saucers, such as mental phenomena. And the Americans aren't doing very well because they've said, we're working on the problem, they're willing to exchange credentials and talk to us. So here it is, 1950, the Americans are telling the Canadians mental phenomena is part of the flying saucer phenomena.
Right.
And that is extremely significant because there are no contactees. The first contactees do not appear until a couple days after the detonation of the first hydrogen bomb, November of 1952, Adamski and Williams had come forward.
Right.
The people who are claiming abduction don't come forward until Betty and Barney Hill's book is published in 1966. So there is nobody in 1950 talking about telepathy. There's nobody talking about aliens. There's nobody talking to aliens.
Right.
All it is from 47 to 52 is the flying saucers flying around.
Right.
Nobody's talking to them. There's no interaction. So this is tremendously significant, the fact that Americans tell the Canadians that mental phenomena is involved. And the question comes down is to how would they know before anybody's talked to an alien? And I'm saying now it is because in Roswell, the crash of Roswell,
yes.
the prominent story now is there was a live alien.
Right.
So when you go to pick up the craft, pick up dead bodies, there's this live alien, and the alien is talking in their heads.
Right.
And they go, this is significant. we're covering this up. That is one of the main reasons for the cover up, is the fact that this mental phenomenon thing is part of it. It's, you know, the ability to get into somebody's head, talk in somebody's head. Anyway, that's the first thing that pops into my head from Colin Andrews. He's talking. This memo, this thing of the memo that I'd never really realized. The second thing that came into my head was I mentioned that we were after the president of the State University, is Dr. Eric Walker.
Yes.
And Walker knew everything. He confirmed that he'd been at a set of briefings that had been taken, that had been given to high-level scientists at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in 1950, said, I don't talk about this subject, go talk to somebody else.
Right.
Unless you're the mind of Einstein, you're not going to get anywhere with this. And he basically didn't want to talk, but he couldn't hang up the phone. So various researchers from around the world are phoning him and bugging him.
Right.
And one researcher from Britain is phoning him, and he's bugging him about the elusive MJ-12 group. Who's
right.
on MJ-12? Is it all American still, or is it international? Are there more than 12 people on the group now? And Walker cuts him off and he says, look, let me ask you a question. What do you know about ESD?
Mm.
And the guy in Britain has no answer. So Walker answers his own question. He says, look, unless you understand about ESD and how it works, you will not be taken in. He's talking about the control room. Not be taken into the control room unless you understand how about ESD works. Very few people understand. So, and we had heard this is 1991. I've read this interview numerous times. I didn't realize what he was talking about. Suddenly it popped into my head during this call and answer. That's what he's talking about. It's the conscious thing. It's all got to do with consciousness.
Yes.
That's the key to the whole thing. The third thing that popped into my head was a lecture that was given by Ben Rich. This is 1993.
Yes.
This is a story that's told by Jan Hartson, and he's now the international director from MUFON, and he's told the story a number of times in the last couple of years. But I knew this story early on, that he had been at this lecture. Ben Rich is giving this lecture. The last slide that Ben Rich gave was in his 1993 lecture to the alumni, engineering alumni at UCLA, is a slide of a flying saucer. And he says, we now have the technology to take ET home.
Right.
And everybody in the audience laughs. And Jan Hartson is sitting there with a guy by the name of Tom Keller. And they both realized, like, this is significant. I mean, this guy has just sort of unloaded the fact that this is Skunk Works. He's the head of Lockheed Skunk Works,
right,
which is in charge of the U-2, the SR-71, all the drones that are flying around. And it was always rumored that Lockheed Skunk Works had the back engineering of flying saucers. And suddenly the head of Lockheed Skunk Works stands up and says, yes, we've got the technology taking you home. We've discovered the mistake in the equation. It won't take us a lifetime to do it. Take an act of thought to get this thing out of Congress so people act. So at the end of the lecture, Jan Hartson and a number of people go in there asking him questions, and he elaborates a little bit more about what he's talking about, this flying saucer thing. And then as he's leaving the room, Jan Hartson realizes, this is stupid. I have to talk about this guy. He chases Ben Rich, and as Ben Rich is leaving the building, he says, Ben, I need to know. I'm interested in flying saucers. I need to know. How do they get here? I'm interested in propulsion. How do they get here? And Ben Rich turns around and he says to him exactly what Dr. Eric Walker said in 1991.
Right.
He says, let me ask you a question. What do you know about ESP? And Jan Hartson was shocked. He said, I didn't realize there was a question coming. So he said, well, that just means that everything in time and space is connected. And Ben said, that's how it works. Walks out of the building and gets in his car and drives away. And Jan Hartson contacted him, but at that time, Ben was on a speaking tour. He said he would talk to Jan Hartson's group. And then he ended up dying, had cancer, he ended up dying, so Jan never got to elaborate on this whole thing. But in 2012, these things pop into my head.
Right.
And this is the fact that consciousness is part of the secret to the cover-up, and it's the whole deal of what we have to understand. So I began this whole sort of chase after consciousness, after mental phenomena, after this kind of stuff, to fit it in.
Excellent.
And then what happened ties into what we're talking about, this manuscript that I'm writing now on consciousness downloads. What happened is I'm going through all these various things to tie mental phenomena into UFOs. I become very good friends with a guy by the name of Chris Bledsoe. Chris Bledsoe is an abductee out of Fayetteville, North Carolina. He and five other witnesses were in this bizarre incident with 14 UFOs. There's aliens in the bush. There's, you know, he believes he's been abducted. He gets a regression, and he comes public. He gets the regression. He comes public. He's in a very sort of Bible Belt area. He gets sort of ostracized by everybody in the community. He has an experience exactly the same day that I have a downward experience in Phoenix, Arizona. Wow. He comes in contact with what he calls the shining thing. In 2 days, the experience in 2007, the regression in 2008, he talks about it. Everybody gives him a hard time. He shuts up. 2012, he gets what he calls pulled by the shining light. He refers to her like an angel type figure.
Right.
And she, the aliens take him to this woman, and she says to him, Chris, you have a burden, and it is yours to carry. Mm. And so Chris, I said, well, you know what the burden is? He says, yeah, I know what the burden is. The burden is the message. I've been given a message to bring to the world. And now Warner Brothers is doing a movie. I think it's about an $85 million movie. They're doing a movie on this abduction, this whole message to the world, what's in the message, what the aliens want us to know. And anyway, I got to be very good friends with Chris, and because of this connection, and one very dramatic event happened when I was at his house, which I think will be in the movie. But anyway, I'm talking to him, and then suddenly he contacts me by email, and he says to me, he says, I've gotten a message from the aliens, and it's to tell you that they're influencing modern music.
Yeah.
And I am to look to the music for the message. And I went, okay, fine, good. And I sort of threw the email to the side because I'm, as I've described to numerous people, I'm a music idiot. I mean, totally illiterate. My mother was a church organist for 40 years. My father built theater organs. My sister's had a group. I played in a religious group that toured the country and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And I did nothing. I played football, baseball. I couldn't care less. I still don't care about music.
Right.
So anyway, when he gave me this thing about the fact that music, that the aliens were influencing music, right, it really didn't mean anything to me. Then what happened was, and this really got me going, Colin Andrews does a lecture with Mike Clown from The Hidden Experience. Mike Clown does interviews with experiencers around the country.
Right.
And during that lecture, Colin suddenly starts talking about aliens and music. And he talks about Reg Presley, who was his best man for his second wedding. Reg Presley has this experience where he talks about the download, getting the download of the song Love Is All Around, 1968,
right,
in the time in Great Britain, the time when the Beatles were ruling Great Britain. This, right, is on the chart for 12 weeks. It beat out the Beatles. So he got this conscious download of this song, all the words, the lyrics, everything, the music. And he, right, came up, so Colin tells this story, and Colin tells the story of the Hinder from the Moody Blues, which had sold 300 million albums, major, right, band. And the Moody Blues came to him after he gave a crop circle lecture and said to him, we want you to, we want to talk to you. So they go out for dinner, and he said, Mike Binder and the lead guitarist for the Moody Blues are talking to him. And they're telling him this story about the fact that they've been given the job of putting messages into music,
yes,
by the aliens,
yes,
and that they remember before they were born being given the job. They remember being or sitting around a round table in this round object, and they remember coming into the world, and they knew this was their purpose. And Colin Andrews said, I mean, if you hadn't seen these two guys back and forth, you would never believe the story. But he said they were talking it back. One guy would tell part of the story, the other guy would tell part of the story, and they told this story, the same story that Chris Bledsoe told me, that the aliens are influencing music.
Absolutely,
and then he,
yeah,
told me the story of John Anderson. John Anderson from ES. And he's been,
right,
interviewed a couple times now. And a major band out of Great Britain. And John Anderson tells about the fact that he had been influenced.
Down
and
by the river.
Yeah. And so, and then the one story that he has not told public yet, he's told it to five people personally that I know, and that is the fact that he was in Las Vegas, Nevada with the band Yes. He was touring with Yes, and he was in his hotel room at the Caesar's Palace, and that an alien came through the wall,
yeah,
and gave him information.
Right.
So Colin mentions four. Renaissance was another band that had come to him and told him the story. So I basically got obsessed with this thing, and I started to look, and it is unbelievable how many bands are into UFOs who have written about it, and you're looking at Presley, you're looking at the Stones, you're looking at, they've all had these experiences.
Led Zeppelin.
Yes. Led Zeppelin, all the download type things that had, like Led Zeppelin. I was just working the last couple of days, this whole thing about Led Zeppelin, about Stairway to Heaven, their,
right,
most famous song, it was automatic writing, and they clearly state that it was done by automatic writing. The guy's hand started to write the lyrics on it. So what I did is I produced a lecture that I did in the spring of this year, and I was down in the south of the United States, and I talked about sort of consciousness downloads, and I went to the music thing. and I talk about all the Kiss and the Hagar and all these people that claim to have been abducted, clearly abducted, and I listed them all, and it's just incredible. It's like it's almost like they've got everybody.
Right,
and that
right.
They are getting these messages of love, of oneness, of all these
yes.
messages that are coming through the music.
The Wheels in the Sky song, the Wheels in the Sky are burning.
Yes, yes.
All of that. When I'm going along on the radio, I can pick out every song that's, and I say to the person in the car, this song is all about UFOs. And some of the songs, the lyrics are describing things that if only if you're on a certain ship would you know that was true. And that tells me they were beamed up and they've seen those things.
Yeah, exactly. You know, some of them are very clear that you, somebody, number of songs that I knew.
Right.
That for years, and then when you see the actual lyrics after I learned this, and you look at the lyrics, and the one there's two songs that Chris had given to me when he gave me the original email. One was Led Zeppelin's Kashmir, the song Kashmir. Now
right.
at that time they'd never been to Kashmir, and they wrote a song called Kashmir.
Right.
And I've never still have not listened to. I've listened to part of it.
I'm very familiar with the song.
What comes up when I go through this whole thing is that Kashmir, if you look at the trailer for John Carpenter, the UFO movie, you will see in the trailer, you will see the alien chanting Kashmir in the trailer. And it's like, wow, it's like the synchronicity type thing. And the other one that he gave me was the song by Neil Young. Neil Young comes from Winnipeg. I'm from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada.
Right.
Neil Young comes from Winnipeg, and the song that he wrote was called After the Gold Rush.
Mm-hmm.
You're in 1968. This
right.
is the second song that Chris told me to look at that he believed was one of the songs. And that song basically talks about the fact that it's an environmental song. It's a big environmentalist. He's trying to stop the oil sands project up in Asia, supporting the Aboriginals who are trying to stop the oil sands and stuff like that.
Right.
He lives in California now. But the song is basically says that we're treating the world like a bull rush. Look at the lyrics. It says we're treating the world like a bull rush. And when the gold is gone, the world will become like a ghost town. And the aliens will come in their silver seeds, those are the silver seeds, and pick up the chosen and
right.
take them to another planet. And you look at this and you go, like, wow. And then I look at the people who did the song after him.
Yeah.
And there was about three other people. Dolly Parton was one. I haven't done the check on Dolly Parton yet. She went to Joe. Dolly Parton went to him and said, "What does the song mean? What are we talking about in this song?" And he said, "I have no idea." He said, I was totally stoned when I wrote the song. I have no idea what the song meant.
Right.
And she said, so her and Linda Ronstadt and some other, there was three of them who wrote the song. But there are two other abductees who have sang that song from Neil Young's song. And I know that they're abductees, but I put it in this sort of this manuscript I'm working on right now, and you see these kind of synchronicities. So anyway, I'm giving this lecture across
right.
the southwest of the United States on this download and the songs and the musicians, and I'm playing some of the songs, this kind of thing, and I get the Boulder, Colorado.
Uh-huh.
Now, Boulder, Colorado is sort of an environmental capital of the world. It's
right.
all yuppies, very rich. Everybody's
Speed
going
town.
To spiritual classes. It's
right.
just, I call it Consciousness Colorado.
Right,
I mean,
right.
And I've lectured there a number of times. I know I'm very good friends there. So I give this lecture, and I give this lecture,
right.
and at the end of the lecture, the question starts. And I've never really had this happen before. It was like a war. I mean, it was like when a woman stood up and she said, you've got to be mistaken in this. This is not aliens influencing music. This is the devil. And she brought up Katy Perry, because Katy Perry sings the E.T. song.
Right.
And so Katy Perry's the devil, and this is the devil, and it's influencing modern music. And I went, come on, give it a break. And I started going, I talking back and saying, you know, there's really evil if you look at it, this kind of stuff.
Right.
And then another woman brings it up, and she's on the same thing.
Wow.
And then somebody gets up and walks out, and I'm going, wow. And
right.
it's like, I got, deluged with this whole thing that there's evil in modern music, that the devil is, that rock musicians are druggies, that they're in with the devil and all this kind of stuff. And I've known all that kind of stuff. And I'm thinking, well, you know, and I was kind of shaken when I came out of it. So what I said was, as I said, my mother was a church organist for 40 years. My father built church theater organs, although he wasn't religious. And I said, well, let's go back and check.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, let's go back.
It makes me think of Tipper.
What's that?
Tipper wanting to label all the bad records.
Yeah, yeah. That's the thing. It sort of set me for a loop. So what I decided to do is I go back and look at all the church music, because I know all the church music. My mother played it for years. Mm-hmm. So I go back and look at Bach and Handel and Beethoven and all the old musicians and say, you know, before the drugs got in here, what's the deal? And what I found out was exactly the same thing. Exactly, no different whatsoever. Even you take the Battle Hymn of the Republic, was channeled. It was automatic writing.
Right.
The woman got up in the middle of the night and wrote this thing out and woke up in the morning, and there was the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Yes. And there was a number of them. Mozart talked about automatic writing,
right,
about writing lyrics where the lyrics are just being written. The same thing as Stairway to Heaven. That's where it comes down to this thing. This whole thing comes to this Stairway to Heaven, this channel where the other guy was writing, where they said the devil took over his hand. And so you get this religious thing. And what I established was that this has been going on all the way through music.
Sure.
And suddenly realized that it was not unique that modern day musicians were getting these downloads, like, you know, Paul McCartney, Yesterday, the big song Yesterday, came in a dream. There was a number of them. Paul McCartney had a second song called No Regrets that he dreamt that he was playing with the Rolling Stones. And then he woke up and he said, well, that was a good song that the Rolling Stones played there. And then suddenly realized, they never played that song. And he quickly wrote the song down. So this kind of stuff has been going on all the time. And when I saw that old musicians, Bach, Beethoven, all the way back through history, were doing the same thing, that they were talking about the fact that it wasn't coming from them, that they were getting this from someplace else. And it's at that point I started on what I call this inspiration and download. And I start going through all the different things. Like I have all the unpublished musicians. As I've been giving the lecture, I've got a lot of contactees inside the folk community, people who have been experiencers or contactees or whatever,
right,
who will come to me and say, well, I wrote a song. And then they'll send me the song. And they'll say, well, you can't publish it. I have one girl who's an experiencer out of Colorado,
mm-hmm,
who opened for, she never published a song, wrote a song called The Heart. And she had actually opened for Pat Boone at 15 years old in Nashville.
Wow.
She was going to be prominent and had a head injury, a car accident,
mm-hmm,
ended her career at 17 years old, and that was it. But she's an experiencer, and she's got these songs. Her son's a professional musician. He's writing these songs. So you have all these people. And then I start looking at all the different things. And it's just everything. And what I say when I give a lecture is I say, if you think that the world is a rational place and all you have is your five senses and your ability to reason, you're making a total mistake,
right,
because most of what we have is coming from someplace else.
Right.
And so I go through, for example, I go through Nobel Prizes. I say, if you think it's just five senses and just rational stuff, you go to the different Nobel Prizes, like in dreams. Insulin came in a dream.
Right.
The DNA molecule, the double helix came in a dream.
Right.
The idea of chemicals moving around in the brain, that came in a dream. Einstein's theory of relativity came in a dream. And Einstein said his whole life was based on his dream. This whole life after that dream, everything after that was based on that dream that he had.
Wow.
So you take a look at this kind of stuff and you start to see these downloads. And in for example, inventions, you get things like the Xerox machine,
right,
which the guy claimed clearly that he had spirits were telling him how to build the Xerox machine. And the guy that financed all the reincarnation research that was done by Ian Stevenson back in North Carolina at Duke University.
Yes.
He financed all that because he had this experience himself. So what you get is this world where we're being helped by angels, spirits, aliens, by all these sort of non-local things,
right,
that are tapping in, and that you can actually do it. I've been working on this lately, that you can actually do this principle, and the name is escaping me here. It's the idea that when you go to sleep, just before you go to sleep, there's this period, a hypnagogic state, and it was used by Edison. Edison had 2,300 patents, and he had the light bulb, he had the hardline telephone type thing. He had a lot of major inventions, and he would do this type of thing where he would sit in his chair, and he would take two metal balls, and he would hold them in his hand, he'd put his arm over the chair, and then he would nap. He was famous for not sleeping at night, and he would nap. And as soon as he would go to sleep, he would had let go of the ball, then he had a metal bowl underneath him, and as soon as the balls hit the metal, it would wake him up again. Then he'd pick up the balls, put his hand on the chair, and he would do the same thing again. So what he was doing is he was going into that state, this between sleep and being awake,
right,
where you enter this non-realm. And that's when he would take notes, and he had 3,000 notebooks filled with all this material. That's how he was getting the material, is he was going into this hypnotic type state,
right,
where just before he goes to sleep, and then as soon as he would drop the balls, he would quickly write down what he was getting out of this other realm. And he came up with all these inventions. And then when I started to look, I realized that all sorts of people were using this technique.
Right.
That there is this technique and there is this other realm. And so I've sort of got onto this thing now where I just sort of chase after, scientists who have looked at it. And I get into this thing of savants. And it's the same sort of thing where you take a look at autistic savants, prodigious savants. And I think some of the most important research that will establish the fact that it is not a physical world, that yes, there is a spiritual element to this world, has just been done, and the lecture is about to take place in California, has to do with savants. Because savants are these people who are able to do these mathematical marvels in their heads. They can't speak, they can't talk, somebody has to dress them and stuff like that. But right, they're either at 3 years old, they can play, they compose 5 symphonies by the time they're 5 years old, or they're able to do all this kind of stuff. For the one girl at 8 years old, hears a woman on a phone giving the time, and she's totally blind, blind since birth, and she's now in her 50s, and at any point of the day or night, you can ask her what time it is, and she's blind, she can tell you to the minute what time it is. Right. So these savants have these unbelievable talents, and the key is that when a savant does something, it's 100%. So if you give them 2 7-digit numbers and say, multiply this number against this number, they will multiply it in their head. They don't have to be 2 out of 3. They're going to get it every single time. Right. They're 100% accurate every single time.
They're tapping into that consciousness.
With that, they're into that other realm.
Right.
And the whole idea is that you have your left brain, which is your rational brain. And then you have your right brain, which is the brain that deals with the spirit type stuff. And these people all have left brain damage. So what I say is basically a savant is somebody whose brain has gone for coffee, whose rational brain, the one that causes all the noise. When you try to meditate, you can't meditate,
right,
and the voice keeps talking, that's your left brain that's being a pain in the rear end, that's blocking you,
right,
from doing it.
Right.
So because the savants have the left brain damage, the left brain is out of the picture, and the right brain is able to do this kind of stuff.
Right.
And what happened was, because they're 100% accurate, there's a woman that I met at a conference one time. Her name is Dr. Diane Powell. Mm-hmm. And she was a neuroscientist. She was trained at John Hopkins, was actually with John Mack at Harvard University Hospital.
Right.
And she's a psychiatrist. And she started working with savants. She was working with savants. And she suddenly realized there was a lot of savants who say that they're psychic. And what happened was, she looked at this a bit, and then she got a woman who had contacted her. There was a nonverbal autistic girl, 10 years old. I think she's in the United States. I'm not sure who this girl is.
Mm-hmm.
And she has 2 handlers, people who take care of her. Right. And her handlers, who takes care of her, mm-hmm, got the impression that this girl was reading her mind. So she said to the girl, she said, "How do you say I love you in German?" Now, in the old days, you couldn't deal with it. You couldn't talk to autistic savants, or like the non-verbal savants, the ones that are really left brain damaged, where they have no ability to talk or anything like that.
Right.
But now you can, because they teach them to work on, use a keyboard.
Right.
So what she said to the girl, she said, "Can you tell me how to say I love you in German?" And the girl, who had never spoken German, never had any German, typed out on the keyboard how to say I love you in German.
Mm-hmm.
And she went, wow. She contacted Diane Powell, and she said, "I think this girl is reading my mind." So Diane went, she did some tests. These were just done in the last couple of months. Mm-hmm. And what she did is, because the autistic savants are 100% accurate, she would give them numbers. And if you ever listen to Russell Targ, who's worked with Al Puthoff on the remote viewing for the CIA,
right,
back in the 1970s, he is the expert in ESP. There's nobody that knows more about ESP than Russell Targ. He had the government funding. He's been through all this kind of stuff. He's written,
right,
piles of books on this. And he will basically talk about this thing as well, about the, the fact that you have your left brain, your right brain, and that his statement was that when they did the remote viewing, they would do what was called symbol. I can't remember the name of the. They used, instead of using numbers, they would give them objects, right. And so you could pick the object. You could see images, but you couldn't see numbers. He said we're illiterate when it comes to numbers, so you couldn't read the stock board when they're doing stuff with stocks, stocks or the silver market and stuff like that.
Right.
You could if you did this thing where you used objects instead of numbers, and the people could describe whether it's going up or down, this kind of stuff. So in ESP, we can't see numbers. We can't see that kind of stuff. Or the remote viewers. But these autistic savant kids that Diana Powell was doing, she was doing 18 and 19-digit numbers. So she'd give the kid, she'd have the handler or the keeper would be in the other room. She would have a piece of paper. She'd look at a 19-digit number. The autistic savant who couldn't talk would be in the other room. And she would give her the thing, write the number down, and the kid would hit punches out of the keyboard. And she was going 18, 19-digit numbers, and they were completely accurate, which is unheard of.
Right.
Because in normal ESP, it's like, you know, someone says, what's a number from 1 to 10, and you guess it, you go, wow, I'm not
going to
do it. You go, 1 out of 10 chance. And this kid's picking off 18 and 19-digit numbers every single time.
Wow.
I mean, the odds of this are just astronomical. There's no way you can say this is chance. Then she gives the kid, this is the one that she's giving this lecture, Concord, California, in August of this year. She's at the parapsychology. She's giving the lecture. And this has all been taped. It's all double blind. It's all on video. This kid doing this. She gives the kid a 162-digit number.
Wow.
And when I wrote the article, I put a number and said, this is what a 162-digit number looks like.
Wow.
She gives it to the kid. They give it to the kid. The kid punches it out. She gets 7 wrong, which is very unusual for a savant.
Wow.
She gets 7 wrong. So Diane goes to the child. She gives her the instruction. You've got 7 wrong. The kid starts punching it out again. The second time she did it, 162 right. 162 out of 162. That is unbelievable. That is like 10 to the 162nd power when it comes to the chances of that being done by chance.
Right.
And to show you how big that number is, there's only 10 to the 80th atoms in the known universe. A 10 to the 81th power is all the atoms in 10 known universes.
Wow.
10 to the 82nd power is 100 universes, all the atoms. So 162nd power. This is an unbelievably massive number. This kid picked off. So here we have a situation where, it's been confirmed. This is out of the park. I don't know what, because she's said that James Randi spent $1 million, and this is... this is absolute proof that there is a psychic component to life. There's a spiritual component. There's a non-physical element, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And this is absolute proof. Now, how Randy's going to get out of this thing, I'm not really sure, because the key thing with a savant is it's not like if you and I were to do a test and then you were to go and under skeptical conditions, you sort of get rattled. A savant could care less. You know about savants, you know about autistic kids. I used to work with them. When I was working,
right.
I used to work with autistic kids, and I know they could care less. They are in their own little world. They do not look you in the eye. They do their little thing. They're doing their little whatever their little shtick is. I had one guy who would do sports. You could ask him anything about sports. You could ask him about movie stars, and he knew everything and stuff like that. But they don't look you in the eye. They're really not worried about you. Can't rattle them.
Right.
And that's the key. Is you have these experiments that have now been done, which have led us into this whole realm that we have a secular world where there is no God, where it's all random chance, where it's all big accidents and stuff like this. And now I think we're sort of turning the corner where we're starting to realize, even inside the UFO community, what has happened in the past is people have said, well, we've got to do this scientifically. And I say, well, no, we don't do this. We got to use the scientific method, but you can't do it scientifically because if you look at John Alexander, when he gives his lecture, always talks about this fact that there's only 7% of people in the National Academy of Sciences who have a belief in God. There's only 4% of them believe in any sort of paranormal phenomena. And the reason for that is because they all buy this random theory of evolution, that it's all just a big accident and it's all random and there's no reason to anything and it's all physical. So if the world is all physical, you can't have UFOs, you can't have ESP, you can't have psychic phenomena, you can't have telekinesis. You can't have any of this kind of stuff because it's a physical world. And you buy into the physical world, and that's what happens with science. So when we're trying to convince science that this is for real, they basically say, well, you got to prove it to me. You got to give me something that I can measure, that I can weigh. Right. And they're saying, you've got to show me something physical to prove it. And you can't because it's really not a physical phenomenon.
That's right.
So that's a long answer to your very first short question.
So when they close off everything else outside of the physical world, they're leaving a big part of the world out of the picture.
They're leaving the entire world out of the picture. If you look at quantum physicists, and what they've used is this thing, they call it the Copenhagen interpretation, is we don't answer these questions about how, what does this mean? It's shut up and talk. And so they're right. working on these things, but we want elegant mathematical formulas and describing the universe. But what I say is basically they're not explaining anything. Science does not explain anything. All science does is describe stuff. And I talk about it like Bible stories. I say it's about like a Bible story. It's like Moses, the children of Israel are being chased by the Egyptians, and they race along. And Moses comes along with his staff, and he's going to rescue them. And they go to the edge of the Red Sea, and Moses takes his staff, and he puts it on the Red Sea. The Red Sea opens, and they go prompted through there, and they get to the other side. And then the Egyptians come through, and Moses hits the staff on the water, and the things closes up and the Egyptians all drown. And that's what science is doing. Is they're basically saying, okay, there was a big bang, and then gravity came along, and then the planets formed, and this happened. And they're just basically telling a Bible story. It's like, how do you do the trick? How do you open the Red Sea? How did Moses do it? Where does the gravity come from? Where does all the material from the universe come from? Or a guy that I always listen to that some of your listeners may know, Terrence McKenna, really right. makes fun of this. Him and
out of New Mexico.
And Rupert Sheldrake is big on okay. The model I say you have to follow is Rupert Sheldrake, the morphogenetic field thing, which I can get right. into. But Terrence McKenna talks about science describing the beginning is the Big Bang thing. He said it is the limit case for credulity in the modern world.
Right.
Because it basically says that everything came from nothing. All the laws of the universe. Because laws can't, you say, we evolved because of random mutations, but you can't have laws like gravity, strong nuclear force, weak nuclear force, electromagnetic, all these different laws of the universe that make the universe work. They can't, there's no genetics in it. So they have to be there and all be working at the first second that this starts. So he says you have all the energy, all the mass, all the laws of the universe all appear at this at a moment at the same time. For no apparent reason, he said, that is the limit case for credulity. If you can believe that, you can believe everything.
Right.
You can believe anything. And that's absolutely true. That's basically what it comes down to. And what he says is, what science has said is, you give us one giant miracle, and we'll explain the rest. But we get to start with a giant miracle.
Right.
And that's what's happened, is they're basically telling these stories, and they're living. And the story I always use is, if you ever come across a scientist, they say, well, we've explained the universe, like Hawkins says, we don't need God. We have the laws of science.
Right.
And I say, well, who are the laws of science? Who is this guy? He sounds like the laws of science. He sounds like a guy, an old man with a white beard sitting on a cloud. He sounds like Spider-Man. Spider-Man does whatever a spider can. He sounds like Santa Claus. Who the hell is the laws of science? And
right.
So that's what they'll say is we have these laws and we have these things. But basically, you ask them, create an oak leaf for me. Make an oak leaf. They'll say, oh, that's easy. You just get an acorn, you put it in the ground, and you know, some soil goes over it, and it gets the warmth and the moisture and whatever, and it grows up, and an oak leaf will appear. And then it's like, no, you do it. The oak tree knows how to make an oak leaf.
Right.
You don't know how to do it. All you're doing is describing how the oak leaf gets created by nature, God, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
And that's all science is doing. And that's what we have to remember, is that when you come right down to it, and the quantum physics that was done, whether it was Einstein didn't like the idea, but the guys who did the whole thing about the wave particle thing, this double slit experiment, stuff like that, and they basically quantum physics basically comes down to this thing that there is no physical universe. There is nothing physical. There is space. That if you take all the human beings in the world, and you take out all the space between their atoms, you are left with a pile of matter the size of a grain of rice. It is all space.
Right.
And so you take it and you look and you suddenly realize it's all space. And then you break it down even farther than that, and all you get is these waves of probability. And quantum physics will describe this, that everything breaks down to these waves of probability, and that there is no matter, and that you need consciousness to break down the wave to form the matter. And that is a critical part of modern-day quantum physics, that you need consciousness to create matter. So consciousness is the basics of the universe, and matter is secondary. It's consciousness creates matter. Whereas in the secular scientific world, what they'll say is this thing that the brain is creating consciousness, and that when you die, then it goes out like a light bulb, and when you go, you just throw it back at him and say, like, he's probably killed. I'm like, oh, so where's the image? What, have you got a little screen in your head? I mean, where's that image taking place? I mean, what's actually going on there? Because when you look out into the world, all it is this quantum soup of waves of probability that your mind is taking, and it's putting together into this image, but the mind is not in the brain. And yet, when you take a look at it, almost all neuroscientists and psychologists still hold this idea that the brain is creating consciousness. And it's as stupid as looking at a TV and saying, I see the back of the TV, I can see that when the football game is on, this TV, look, it lights up there, it lights up in there, and stuff like that, and there are people playing football inside that TV. It's that kind of nonsense that is happening in the brain, and it isn't.
Right.
So we started to learn that, and I think we rounded the corner that we've got them on the run, because they basically have no answers to these questions. They just basically don't want to talk about it.
Well, if you look at the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it's not about being dead, it's about consciousness. It's about consciousness without a body. It explains all of this perfectly. And what you're bringing up reminds me of the science of Thomas Vallone. He said that if you look at Betty Hill's star map, he tells his friends, his astronomer friends, look at her star map, it's perfect. And he can bring us the science that explains all of this, what you're saying about the quantitative scientists out there.
Yeah. I even have a chapter in this manuscript. I have a chapter on ancient knowledge, and I go through the Buddhists and the Hindus, and everybody knew this. I mean, we're just catching on to this now, because we got into this thing, you know, in the 16th century, where we sort of separated religion and science basically took over and said, you know, we're not going to talk about religion anymore, and built this material world. But before then, I mean, everybody had this idea that that the consciousness was the key part. Or even if you get into ancient tribes, like the whole ayahuasca, I got a lot into that because I got this sort of attack after this lecture about the use of drugs, and I knew this was going to come up. Mm-hmm. I go through, I have a chapter on psychedelic drugs, and it ties into ancient cultures, like all these tribes in Brazil and Peru and Colombia and stuff like this, and they all knew about ayahuasca. They all knew about these two plants that if you mix them, you get this sort of called death experience. It's like dying. It's the long night where, you know, you throw up and you go into fevers and stuff like that.
You're going into consciousness.
Yeah, and you end up talking to these entities who basically judge you. It's like basically, Sting was one. Sting was from Police. He was a famous head singer, and he went through this, and he said, if you think this is recreational drugs, think again. That this is it's the only drug that anybody takes where your hands and your knees will shake before you take it, because you know what's coming.
Yeah.
That this is that you get judged, and it's apparently it's even been used to get people off cocaine and heroin, that it's so traumatic, the judgment type thing that takes place there. And so you have these ancient cultures who've known about all this stuff, and have respected all this kind of stuff, and we've gotten into this sort of thing where we believe that because these scientists are producing cars and technology and stuff like that, that they're on the right track, and they're sort of teaching us. But what you get on the other hand is you realize what scientists have said and what the aliens have told us, and what we've gotten downloads from other sources are telling us, is that we are about to put the Earth off the edge of the cliff. This is the whole Neil Young after the gold rush idea. That, you know,
the biosphere.
I think Yvonne Smith has talked about every single person that she's regressed for 23 years has been given this message, this message of, you know, collapse, and the fact that we're running out of time, and this sort of stuff.
Right.
And so science brings you the good stuff, but it's also bringing you the bad stuff. And when you get into the whole consciousness thing, you get into the holographic universe type idea.
Right.
And that came from Perbrim and Lasher did research on the brain in the 1950s.
Hmm.
And their brain research, they took a rat, and well, it was actually Lasher who did the research. What they would do is they would teach these rats to run through a maze. Then they'd take the rat, they cut out different parts of the brain, and then they'd run the rat through the maze again, and the rat could keep running through. It didn't matter what part of the brain you cut out, it was running through the maze. So then they came to the conclusion that there was no center of memory in the brain because they couldn't cut it out.
Right.
And then Perbrim came along, and Perbrim realized that it was called fortune mathematics. It's a formula where all your senses, whether it's touch or sight or hearing, what it does is it takes the wave and it does this mathematical calculation, and it produces a wave that is interpreted by the brain, and it's called fortune transforms.
Right.
When they got that, so they realized that the brain didn't have a center of consciousness, but it was used as fortune stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in 1964, the guy invented the hologram. It came in a dream. The whole idea came in a download, sitting on a park bench, and he got this impression about how to create a hologram. He creates the hologram, and it uses 14 transforms. So the whole thing with the hologram is that you're using these two different sort of images, and they're sort of, all it is these waves interacting with each other, and if you look at it and send a beam of light through it, it will form this three-dimensional image.
Amazing.
And the key was, it was using the same thing as the brain. So that's where the idea came that the mind, the brain, that all the memory in the brain was not local, same as it is in a hologram. Because you can take a hologram, you can break it in half. If it's a picture of a rose, you'll have two roses. And all the information in both holograms is the same, that you don't lose any information. It may be a little fuzzier, but it's the same information. And you can break that hologram into a million pieces, and it will always still have all the information contained in the main hologram.
Right.
And it was the same thing with the brain, that the brain, so they developed this idea of the holographic universe. Now, one of the guy that came up with the name, was a guy by the name of David Bohm, and he was a guy who did all the original work on quantum physics stuff on plasmas in the 1950s. And he came up with this idea that plasmas, when you get a plasma, the electrons actually start to interact with each other. They start, like, they have a common brain that they start making this move. But he came up with the idea of the holographic universe, that the universe is holographic. And he wasn't a UFO guy. He wasn't a real consciousness guy, stuff like that. But when he talked about it, he talked about this thing, which I think is extremely important. He talked about the fact that in the world we are about to go up on a cliff. The way he described it was the fact that if you see yourself as an individual, and that's the way science sees ourselves.
Right.
You're a particle. I'm a particle. I may bump into you. You may bump into this. And unless somebody bumps into something, nothing's going to happen. There's just these random particles. And that's what happens in your brain. It's just your random particles are moving around in your brain. So if you happen to be the terrorist that attacked the World Trade Center, it wasn't that you decided to track away World Trade Center. You have no free energy. It's just everybody's brain just happened to all go at the same time, and it was this random pattern, and they all just did this. So brains, it wasn't them.
Right.
So he came up with this idea that when you have this idea in science that everybody's an individual, he said, as long as science has that idea, we are going off the cliff.
Right.
Because basically what it is, it's survival of the fittest. Steal what you can, get what you can, grab what you can. The one with the most toys wins.
Right.
And basically what we're doing is, he said, his description of the world was, it is as if a swarm of locusts has descended upon the earth.
Right.
And basically we're just using up the resources. And it's the model we have. And we always use the model. Even though we may be environmentalists, we still use the model. You send your kids to school, you say to your kids, don't be a bum. Don't be a ditch digger. Man, get an education. Go out there, get an education, because we want you to have a bigger house than we have.
Right.
We have more cars than we have. And we encourage our kids to have more.
Right.
In our society, it's the more you have, the more success you have. And so what we're doing is, it's this growth thing. That when you get no growth, suddenly it's a recession, and everybody's in a panic, and everybody's... And that's when we have a situation where you got 2%, 3%. And what Bohm was saying is that eventually you're going to run out of stuff. You can't have this growth more and more and more unless you suddenly get the idea there is a whole, that there is a oneness. This is a scientist talking. He said, unless you realize that what you do affects the whole, and you put the whole in front of your individual personal goals, we're going off the cliff. And he didn't think we would make it, because and we've seen in the environmental movement, which only started in about 1935, we've seen this move that you can't now just smoke in public. You can't just dump stuff into the oceans and the rivers. You can't just build a nuclear power plant. That what we do affects the whole. The thing is, are we going to catch on fast enough to realize that it is the ecology, the Gaia, the Earth? This is what is important, not what we personally have. We still have this idea that we have to get more. We've got to be successful. We've got to grab more. And we have this growth model of more and more and more. And people, for example, people will talk in for example, disclosure. They'll say, well, we're going to have growth. We'll have growth if we have free energy. And I say, be careful what you're asking for. Because free energy, we're complaining now about China using up the resources. China's growing. It was growing at 10%. Now it's at about 8%. If you suddenly get free energy, how are we going to use it? Are we going to use it to protect the whole, or are we going to use it to get more Chuck E. Cheese type stuff? You take your kid to Chuck E. Cheese. Right. It's like you get all these tickets and you go buy all these things that don't mean anything. Are we going to use free energy? Because if you get a huge growth rate, if you suddenly get the Chinese growing at 20% a year with free energy, get ready. We're going off the cliff even faster than we're going off now. The key idea is not so much what we have, the material, how it all fits together. The key idea is the oneness. It's this idea that everything is one and that we are part of the one, this holographic universe, the sort of the ecology model, that the one is important. And unless we get on board with this, it's game over. And this is the message that the aliens are giving. And this is the message that a lot of other people from different realms are sort of trying to get across, this idea that oneness is critically important.
It could be that if we have massive growth, what if we took that growth in the direction of, you know, organic seeds and doing projects that would transform the earth into an ecologically safe place?
Sure. The problem is you have to be in control. You're not in control. You can see who's in control right now. And that's where we have to put out the message ourselves, that we have to create this movement ourselves. And we have to take control of this thing and educate as many people as possible. That consciousness changes, and people will say, "Well, it's game over. The world's coming to an end." And I always say, "Well, no. If you take a look, the world is actually moving along pretty good. I mean, it's just whether we're going to have enough time. Because if you look back 150 years, like a lot of people will give me this in the lecture, they'll say, you know, it's worse than it ever was. And I go, like, are you in the same world as me? I mean, look back 150 years ago. Right. I mean, it was like, oh, it's okay to have a slave. I mean, women, right? Women vote? Are you kidding? Women should vote. They didn't get the vote.
It's all in the U.S. Constitution. No women voting, and you must own a slave.
Yeah, exactly. And so this is the idea that we're starting to get this sort of thing. That and one example I'll use. I mean, you have all the different movements, whether it's civil rights, but the one that we're addressing was the whole gay rights, the gay marriage movement.
Right.
And I remember it was like, when I started youth college back in 75, there's nobody would ever believe this was going to happen. There's just no way. And I remember I was in the States because I travel in the States quite a bit. And I was just to Rush Limbaugh. He's just a humorous guy. I just sort of like to listen to him. And I remember I'm listening to Rush Limbaugh because I'm driving across country. And he goes, and this is like last year, the year before. And he goes, that's it. Give it to them. They've got it. Gay marriage. They've got it. Just give it to them. And I went, wow, there it is. It's like this whole idea of how a movement works, that you move it, you move it, you move it, and suddenly everybody decides, no, it's wrong to smoke in a restaurant. Right. No, it's wrong to do this. And suddenly you hit this point where it's suddenly you're going down the other side of the hill. And it was like Rush for Limbaugh had given up. And it was like, wow, they just game over, and on we went to the next movement. And I think we're moving along, that we're realizing even the idea of ecology, that you couldn't dump stuff into the river. I mean, before 1935, it was like, I could dump whatever I want in the river, get lost. This is my little 50 feet of the river, and dump whatever I want. Now it's changed. You have this oneness idea coming. The problem that's going to happen is that it's always going to be seen as a communist movement. And back in the early days, when ecology first started, when you had Adamski and Williamson and all these guys, that was the message. You were putting out this oneness message. You were putting out this idea that we have to, you know, be one and all this kind of stuff. And the FBI was following around because they were getting messages from their little commie friends. And because they were communists. Because the communist message is the idea that there's a one, that one is more important than the individual. The problem with the communists was that they left out the spirit. So you're a biological robot. So, you know, in the Cultural Revolution in China, I mean, you're a biological robot, you don't have a soul, who cares?
Right.
So up to 78 million people were executed. I mean, if you're in the way of the country, they just exterminate you. Or 20 million people by Stalin during World War II. I mean, this communist atheist notion. And it was like they're in the way, so just exterminate you or can't get 3 million. Look that up, but the idea is the same. And if you look at aliens, I wrote an article called Are the Aliens Commies?
Mm.
And if you take a look, I mean, you look at it, it's like a BI. I mean, everybody's doing their job. There's nobody trying to get a bigger car than anybody else. Nobody's got designer clothes on. Everybody's either got the same clothes or no clothes on. And it's that sort of thing. That's, I think, the roadblock we're going to run up against is the when you look at it, you look at, well, I don't know if everybody really want to live in an alien beehive. I mean, the way they're living, where they just seem to be work, and they're doing saving the world or whatever the heck they're doing. And it's that idea that I think we're going to have a big trouble with, is trying to break the capitalist idea that to have physical possessions is being successful. That's where we got to make the move. But on everything else, we've made the move. I mean, we've got the whole idea about gays and the fact that blacks, and that's what it came down to when it came to the music. It was funny because people would say, and I say it was all relative, because people would say, well, music only became bad when it was heavy metal music. And then people say, no, it was Elvis Presley. And if you remember back when Elvis Presley started, Elvis Presley was considered satanic music.
Right.
You were not allowed to show him. You're not allowed to play him. A lot of history,
obviously,
above
the United
States, because he was playing black music.
Right.
And black music was considered satanic music.
And he was gyrating.
Yeah, and he was gyrating. So blacks were of the devil. He was bringing the devil into music, and that's why he was not allowed to be played. And if you even go back to jazz, when I look back through music, if you take a look in the 1920s, you will see that jazz was considered demonic, satanic music.
Right.
And the reason was because it was played in bars. And God controlled wine, but the devil controlled drunkenness. So if you were in a bar, and it was loose women, and music, and it was all satanic. So jazz and the foxtrot were considered in the 1920s to be satanic music. And a lot of places it was banned. There's a couple of countries that jazz music was actually banned because it was satanic. So you can take this whole sort of thing that we're starting to understand how it fits together. And basically, when you come down to it, you forget all about the satanic and about the music. You forget about everything. And basically, it's all consciousness. And it's you and I going through this whole evolution of learning lessons, of doing all this kind of stuff, which is why I say, and I have not really gotten any success in doing this, I say my idea of disclosure is to ask one single question.
Mm.
One question to everybody who's being regressed, who's had claimed to have been abducted and been regressed. The question is, at any point in the past, did you agree to? When did you first meet these people? Because according to Mary Rodwell, who's done 2,000 regressions in Australia, according to Dolores Cannon, every single person will say, yes, I agreed to this. And that's where it comes down to Chris Bledsoe. Chris Bledsoe does the regression back in 2008. It's Dr. Michael O'Connor, who's an associate of John Mack, is doing the regression. He's doing the regression, and he's talking about promise. I promise, I want to get off. He's talking, I want to promise, I promise. And O'Connor says, what are you talking about? What's this promise? Can you talk to the aliens? Ask the aliens, what is the promise? And he said, they have been with me since before I was born.
Right.
And he basically says, to deliver the message, this is arranged before I was born. And I say, all it's going to take is one proof. It's like the white crow thing. You don't need all crows to be white. You only need one. You need one case to go back before birth where you can sort of prove conclusively that somebody agreed to be a part of this situation. And then the whole UFO thing is no longer physical. It's got nothing to do with anything. It's all spiritual. It's a spiritual problem. We agreed to come into the world at this time to be a part of this whole thing. And that's why one of the things I ask in my lecture, I say, what are UFOs with lights on? And the answer is because they want you to see them.
Right.
If, when they abduct people, you don't see them. If they don't want to be seen, they aren't seen. And we don't need lights on our craft. So when they're seen, they are being seen because they want you to see them.
Right.
Which leads to the question, if you see a UFO, is it random chance or is this mean something? And so I'll play clips. I'll play the clip of Bud Hopkins having his 1964 sighting where he describes his 1964 sighting with two other people in the car. And the thing's just sitting there. They're looking at it. It's plain daylight. They're looking at it. They're looking at it. And he goes back later and he drives the pattern. How long ago was that thing sitting there? And you can tell. I mean, it's absolutely that this was intended, that he may have been a contactee or he was triggered. And you start looking through history of ufology, and what you see is you don't see random. So when I read my thing about consciousness and inspiration and downloads, I say the key thing is the universe pattern or is it chance? And when you look at ufology, you look at the history of ufology and you start looking, it is not random. Nothing is random. It's all pattern. If you look at the first sightings, 1895, 1896, 1897, you had these flying saucers flying around with propellers on them and guys dropping down ropes. When was the last time we had a sighting of a flying saucer with propellers on it? I mean, it was for that specific time. And then it stopped.
Right.
And then it was World War II. You had these Foo Fighters. My father's boss.
Right.
My mother was the Royal Canadian Air Force. They had these Foo Fighters saying, so 1941 to 1945. When was the last time we had a Foo Fighters?
Right.
They stopped in 1945. It was like, I say, it's like the aliens are turning the pages of a book. And all we're doing is watching them turn the pages of a book. As I said before, from 1947, when all this started, the sightings started, nobody talked to an alien until November of 1952. So what were they doing between 1947 and 1952? They were just flying around and letting people look at them.
Right.
1947, 1948, 1949, you had the Green Fireball sightings. You had all the military investments where they were building the atomic bomb, where they were finding the plutonium. You had all these Green Fireball sightings, and the Americans actually investigated all this stuff and confirmed it was an actual phenomenon, and then it stopped. And then you have, you know, the cattle mutilation started in 67, crop circles started in 76.
Right.
You have, back in the, when I was starting out, you had sightings, for example, you had sightings where people would see, they would describe Betty and Barney Hill, for example. Barney's got the binoculars, he's describing, they're looking out the windows, they're looking at me. In the 60s, 70s, early 80s,
right.
All sorts of people, I have clips of little kids talking about aliens looking out the windows. Does not happen anymore. There are no sightings of aliens looking out windows. There are no more sightings of aliens where the flying saucer lands and the aliens out there collecting rocks or plants or running around with a little rod. I had one in my, where I was in the 70s, the guy told me a story about the little alien with the rod that was running around outside the flying saucer. It doesn't happen anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Even ground traces. You know all the stories of ground traces where it leaves block marks and burns the soil and all. Doesn't happen anymore. It's not for 10 years, 10, 15 years.
Rendlesham Forest is that case.
But that's 1980. That's 20
right.
years ago.
Right.
And recently, it doesn't happen anymore. And
right.
even the aliens. You have all the aliens that now are the Greys. The Greys did not appear until 1961, Betty and Barney Hill,
right.
Which is one of the key things, is I say, people get the impression with abduction. They say, okay, abduction is, what's happening is the person's mind blocks it out, and then when their mind is ready, it sort of starts to leak out, and they come to the thing. That's one theory. The other theory is that the aliens put amnesia in there, and it doesn't work very well, and after a while it sort of starts to break down.
Mm.
And the amnesia breaks down, the person gets bad nightmares, and they go for help, and suddenly they find out they've been abducted. If either of those cases were true, then the pattern wouldn't happen the way it happened.
Right.
Jacobs and Hopkins both say that they have clients that will report back to 1900 abduction experiences, but the first reported abduction wasn't until 1961.
Right.
So if, for example, it's amnesia breaking down, if it's the fact that the stuff was put into the person's head, the amnesia breaks down, from 1900 to 1961, that's when you should have all the amnesia breaking down. By 1961, the aliens should have figured out how to do this. But it works the other way.
Right.
It's like perfectly sealed until 1961. And then suddenly everybody starts to remember. And you have Betty and Barney Hill. Then you have this police officer in 67. You have Pascagoula in 73. Then you have Travis Walton in 1975.
Right.
And I bring this up. Travis Walton was taken for 5 days. What, were the all grays on strike? Why would they need him for 5 days?
Right.
They wanted him for 5 days because they wanted this up. They wanted
right.
it out there.
Right.
They wanted everybody to see this case as dramatic. And that's why that happened. You take a look at the communion thing. The communion book, and I haven't confirmed whether Whitley was told to put the alien on the cover. I know he was told to put the communion title. You want to call it body pain or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he's lying in bed at night, and Anne starts to channel. She
right.
starts talking in this male voice and saying, "Oh, we won't call it body pain.
Mm.
We're going to call it communion because
mm.
that's what it is.
Right.
It's a communion." And so he changes the name of the cover to communion.
Right.
And that book, if you go to the communion thing, I tell people, if you think this is all random chance, go to the book communion.
Right.
Look Amazon.com, where you're selling communion, and look at the comments. People commenting, and you'll see one after another. I saw that book. It floored me. I couldn't believe it. So many people got triggered by seeing that book. I talked to one girl who told me she had her kid, your little kid. She saw it on the front of a bookstore. She said she just about dropped the kid.
Right.
She was just horrified when she saw that. And most people, when they see the book, they go, whoa, you know, like, that's it. I've been abducted. They said that was
right.
a trigger. It was like the aliens put that there to trigger people. Or you take the four guys in Maine that were abducted. These guys, what was the four guys? Allagash, the four Allagash guys.
Right.
So they get abducted in 1976, the year after I had my experience.
Right.
They have no idea they've been abducted. All they thought was they outran the UFO. They flashed the lights on the UFO. They chased them across the sort of the lake. They got there, the fire was gone.
Right.
And it was like 3 hours to disappear, but they didn't really put anything together.
They didn't remember being beamed up.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly 11 years later, the two twin brothers both start having nightmares. Now, what's the chances that exactly 11 years later, two of them accidentally start having these nightmares where they have to go for help? And the one guy is so traumatized, he's in a hospital. He tells the story, he's in a hospital.
Right.
And so they want to calm him down, so they bring him a book to read. And guess what book they bring him? Communion.
Yeah,
it's just about to say. And he just about loses it. I mean, what's the chances of them bringing this guy communion? And so this story comes up. And then I tell the story, one of the key stories I tell, I play Barbara Lamb. Barbara Lamb's done 2,000 regressions.
Right.
And I play this tape where Barbara Lamb talks about how she got involved. What she says is, I started my family practice in 1975. I worked through my family practice. And in the 1980s, we were, as part of our training, we were taking regression, hypnotic regression training. And we were at the top level of training. And during that training, she said, the woman said, oh, by the way, from time to time, while you're doing this with your clients, you may come across a weird story. You may get people who will say to you, they were abducted by little gray people. And I just want to let you know. And Barbara Lamb says to herself, she says, that's weird. I've never heard anything like that before.
Mm.
And she says exactly as she says this. She says there's a big booming voice in the back of her head says, listen carefully, you're going to be doing this.
Right.
And suddenly she's got 2,000 people.
Okay, everybody, we're not going to be able to finish the interview. If you go to YouTube, you type in Grant Cameron, Elizabeth Trutwin, you can hear the end. There's a whole nother hour. It's so good. Thanks for joining me tonight. We'll see you next Wednesday. I'm going to play you out now. Have a great week.